Stymie, lovey, I've got 3 beautiful children, and with my genetic quotient, I can have 3 more if I want them. I'm happy as a clam at high tide playing with my kids and torching busted boars and loving up any man who isn't afraid I'll eat him alive. Stymie, what do I need with exile? This is my kind of world. Exploding in 3 million directions all at once. Earthlings increasing and multiplying in every nook of the galaxy, and the race evolving into something fantastic practically before your eyes. You know that one of my kids is coming out meta? It's happening all over the place now. Human biology is evolving right along with human culture for the first time since the old Stone Age. I couldn't miss it, lovey. Not friggity likely.
He broke away and knuckled out tears, disgusted with himself. You better hope I didn't plant anything in your potato patch then, kid. I don't think my genes would meet your standards.
She took his face in both hands and kissed him. I know why you have to go, Blue Eyes. But I've also seen your PS profile. The squiggles in it have nothing to do with heredity, whatever you may think. Given another nurturing situation, you would have turned out fine, laddie.
Animal. He called me a murdering little animal, Stein whispered.
She rocked him again.
He was hurt terribly when she died, and he couldn't know you understood what he was saying. Try to forgive him, Steiny. Try to forgive yourself.
The deep triller began to lurch violently as massive eructations of gas rose from Stromboli's guts. They decided to get the hell out of there before the Sigma field heat shields gave way and burrowed out of the lava chamber via an extinct underwater vent. When they finally emerged on the floor of the Mediterranean west of the island, the driller's hull clanged and pinged with the sounds of rocks falling through the water. They rose to the surface and came into a night of mad melodrama. Stromboli was in eruption, farting red and yellow fire clouds and glowing chunks of lava that arched like skyrockets before quenching themselves in the sea.
"Holy petard," said Georgina. "Did we do that?"
Stein grinned at her owlishly as the driller rocked on steaming waves.
"You want to try for a continental drift?" he asked, reaching for her.
11. Richard Voorhees took the express tube from Unst to Paris to Lyon, then rented a Hertz egg for the last part of his journey. His earlier notion of eating and drinking and screwing his way across Europe and then jumping off an Alp had been modified when a fellow passenger on the liner from Assawamset happened to mention the odd earth phenomenon of exile. That, Richard knew instantly, was just the kind of reprieve he needed. A new start on a primitive world full of human beings with no rules. Nothing to bug you but the occasional prehistoric monster. No green leaky freakies, no dwarf polywogs, no obscene ghee, no glaring krondaku making you feel like your nightmares just came true. And especially, no Lilmic. He started pulling the strings as soon as he got out of decon and was able to get to a teleview. Most exile candidates applied months in advance through their local PS counselors and took all the tests before they ever left home. But Voorhees, the old operator, knew that there had to be a way of expediting matters. The magic passkey had come via a big Earthside corporation, for which he had done a delicate job less than a year ago. It was to the advantage of both the corporation and the ex-spacer that he exit the here and now as soon as possible. And so, with scarcely any arm twisting at all, the outfit's VP operations agreed to use his good offices to convince the people at the auberge to let Richard take abbreviated tests right there at the starport, then proceed directly to go. This evening, however, as he glided out of the Rhone Valley toward the Mont de Lyonnais, he still admitted to a few qualms. He landed at Saint-Antoine-de-Vigny, just a few kilometers from the inn, and decided to have one last meal on free turf. The August sun had dropped behind the Col de la Loire, and the resolutely quaint village drowsed in leftover heat. The café was small, but it was also dim and cool and not, thank God, too cutesy atmospheric for comfort. As he ambled in, he noted approvingly that the tri-D was off. The music box played only a subdued jangling tune, and the smells of food were incredibly appealing. A young couple and two older men, locals by the look of their agri-garb, sat at window tables wolfing large plates of sausage and bowls of salad. On a stool at the bar sat a huge blonde man in a glossy suit of midnight nebulin. He was eating a whole chicken prepared with some pinkish sauce and washing it down with beer from a 2-liter pewter tankard. After hesitating for a moment, Richard went and took another stool. The big fellow nodded, grunted, and kept feeding his face. From the kitchen came the proprietor, a jolly, pot-bellied man with a heroic aquiline nose. He beamed a welcome to Voorhees, spotting him as an off-worlder immediately. "I have heard," Richard said carefully, "that the food in this part of Earth is never prepared with synthetics." The host said, "We'd sooner gastrectomize than insult our bellies with Algeprod or Biocake or any of the rest of that crap diddle. Ask any gorf in the place." "Say again, Louis," cackled one of the oldsters at the window, hoisting a dripping hunk of sausage on his fork. The proprietor leaned on the counter with hands palm down. "This France of ours has seen a lot of change. Our people are scattered over the galaxy. Our French language is dead. Our country is an industrial beehive underground, and a history buff's Disneyland on top. But three things remain unchanged and immortal. Our cheeses, our wines, and our cuisine. Now I can see that you've come a long way." The man's eyelid drooped in a ponderous wink. "Like this other guest here, maybe you still have a ways to go. So if you're looking for a really cosmic meal, well, we're a modest house, but our cooking and our cellar are 4-star, if you can pay for it." Richard sighed. "I trust you. Do it to me. An aperitif, then, which we have chilled and ready. Dom Perignon 2100. Savor it while I bring you a selection of whimsies to whet your appetite." "Is that champagne?" the chicken muncher asked. "And that little bitty bottle?" Richard nodded. "Where I come from, a split of this will set you back 3 centibucks. "No shit. How far out you be, guy?" "Assawomps it. The old assawomp hole of the universe, we call it. But don't you try." Stein chortled around his chicken. "I never fight with a guy till I meet him formal." The host brought a napkin with 2 small pastries and a little silver dish full of white steaming lumps. "Brioche de foie gras, costade de riz de veau à la financière, and quenelle de brochet au beurre d'écavisse. Eat. Enjoy." He swept out. "Financier, huh?" muttered Richard. "There's a good epitaph." He ate the pastries. One was like a cream puff stuffed with delicious spiced liver. The other seemed to be a fluted tart shell filled with bits of meat, mushrooms, and unidentifiable tidbits in Madeira sauce. The dish with white sauce consisted of delicate fish dumplings. "This is delicious, but what am I eating?" he asked the host, who had emerged to take the credit cards of the local diners. "The brioche is filled with goose liver pâté. The tart has a slice of truffle, braised veal sweetbread, and a garnish of tiny chicken dumplings, coxcombs, and kidneys in wine sauce. The pike dumplings are served in creamy crayfish butter." "Good God," said Richard. "I have an outstanding vintage coming up with the main course, but first, grilled baby limb filet with little vegetables, and to set it off, a splendid young fumet from the Chateau de Nozay." Richard ate and sipped, sipped and ate. Finally, the host returned with a small chicken like that which Stein had lately devoured. "The specialty of the house, poulard diva, the most adolescent of young pullets, stuffed with rice, truffles, and foie gras, poached and coated with paprika supreme sauce. To accompany it, a magnificent Chateau Gruyère."
You're kidding, Richard exclaimed.
It never leaves the planet Earth, the host assured him solemnly. It rarely leaves France. Get this behind your uvula, guy, and your stomach will think you died and went to heaven. Once again, he whirled out. Stein gaped.
My chicken tasted good, he ventured, but I ate it with Tuborg.
To each his own, Richard said. After a long pause for attending to business, he wiped pink sauce off his mustache and said, You figure somebody on the other side of the gate will know how to brew up some good booze?
Stein's eyes narrowed.
How do you know I'm going over?
Because you couldn't look less like some colonial gorf visiting the old country. You ever thought about where your next bucket of suds is coming from in the Pliocene?
Christ! Exclaimed Stein.
Now me, I'm a wine freak, as much as I could be, dragging my ass all over the Milky Way. I was a spacer. I got busted. I don't want to talk about it. You can call me Richard. Not Rick, not Dick. Richard.
I'm Steiny.
The big driller thought for a minute. The stuff they sent me about this exile told how they let you sleep learn any simple technology you think would be useful in the other world. I don't remember if it was on the list, but I bet I could cram brewing easy. And the hard sauce, you can make that out of just about anything. Only tricky bit would be the condensation column, and you could whip that up out of copper film decimal and hide it in your hollow tooth if they didn't want to let you in with it on the up. You with your wine, though. You might have a problem. Don't they use special grapes and stuff? Don't they fucking ever, said Richard gloomily, squinting through the glass of Gruyere. I suppose the soil would be different back then, too. But you might be able to come up with something halfway decent. Let's see. Grapevine cuttings, of course, and definitely yeast cultures, or you'd end up with moose pee for sure. And you'd have to know how to make some kind of bottles. What did they use before glass and plass?
Little brown jugs, Stein suggested.
Right. Ceramic. And I think you can make bottles out of leather if you heat and mold it in water.
Christ. Will you listen to me, the hung spacer carving out a new career as a grape squash moonshiner? Could you get a recipe for aquavit?
Stein was wistful.
It's just neat alcohol with a little caraway seed. I'll buy all you can make.
He did a double take.
Buy? I mean, barter or something. Shit, you think there'll be anything civilized waiting for us?
They've had nearly 70 years to work on it.
I guess it all depends, Stein said hesitantly.
Richard grunted.
I know what you're thinking. It all depends on what the rest of the fruitcakes have been up to all this time. Have they got a little pioneer paradise going, or do they spend their time scratching fleas and carving each other's stripes out?
The host came up with a dirty old bottle, which he cradled like a precious child.
And here, the climax. But it'll cost you. Chateau de Chem, 83. The famous lost vintage of the Metapsychic Rebellion year.
Richard's face, furrowed with old pain, was suddenly transformed. He studied the tattered label with reverence. Could it still be alive?
As God wills, shrugged Mon Ot. 4.5 kilobucks the bottle.
Stein's mouth dropped. Richard nodded, and the host began to draw the cork.
Jeez, Richard. Can I hit you for a little taste? I'll pay if you want, but I never had anything that cost so much.
Landlord, 3 glasses. We will all drink to my toast.
The host sniffed the cork, hopefully, gave a beatific smile, then poured 3 half glasses of golden brown liquid that sparkled like topaz in the lantern light. Richard lifted his glass to the other two.
A man may kiss his troll goodbye. A rose may kiss the butterfly. A wine may kiss the crystal glass. But you, my friends, may kiss mine ass.
The ex-spacer and the cafe proprietor closed their eyes and sampled the wine. Stein tossed his down in one gulp, grinned, and said,
Hey, it tastes like flowers, but not much sack to it, is there?
Richard winced.
Bring my buddy here a crock of eau de vie. You like that, Steiny, sort of aquavit without the seeds. You and I, landlord, will continue to bless our tonsils with the Sauterne.
So the evening wore on, and Voorhees and Olsen told each other edited versions of the sad stories of their lives, while the proprietor of the café clucked in sympathy and kept refilling his own glass. A second bottle of Yquem was called for, and then a third. After a while, Stein bashfully told them what Georgina's other farewell presents had been. His new friends demanded that he model them. So he went out into the darkened egg park, got the stuff from the boot, and stalked back into the café, resplendent in a wolfskin kilt, a wide leather collar and belt studded with gold and amber, a bronze Vixo helmet, and a big steel-bladed battle axe. Richard toasted the Viking with the last of the Chateau d'Yquem, which he chug-a-lugged from the bottle. Stein said,
"The horns on the helmet were really, like, ceremonial," Georgina said. "Vikings didn't wear 'em in battle, so these are demountable."
Richard giggled.
"You look perfect, tiny old rascal, just perfect. Bring on the mastodons and dinosaurs and what all. All they have to do is look at you and they'll piss blue."
His face changed.
"Why didn't I bring a costume? Everybody goes back in time needs a costume, why didn't I think? Now I'll have to go through the time gate and fucking civvies. Never did have no class, Voorhees. Dumb damn Dutchman, no fucking class, never." "Oh, don't be sad, Richard," begged the café man. "You don't want to spoil your meal and lovely wine?"
His beady eyes lit with an expression of drunken craft.
"Got it. There's a guy in Lyon, runs the Flicken Opera. Comes up here and eats himself stoporous. And this guy's au cire de cochon over one kind of wine. And I got a whole case you could use to bribe him if you could stand the tab. They got any kind of costume you'd want at the opera. Mer de l'or. It's not even 200 hours yet. Guy might not even be in bed. What say?"
Stein whacked his new buddy on the back, and Voorhees clutched the edge of the bar.
"Come on, Richard, I'll pop for habsies." "I could call the guy up right now," said the smirking host. "Bet he'd meet you at the opera house."
So they did work it out, and in the end, Stein piloted the egg, with the half-conscious Richard, and a case of Chateau Mouton Rothschild 95, down to the Cour Lafayette of Sleeping Lyon, where a furtive figure guided them into the parking subway, and then through a maze of turned-off walkways to the opera's backstage rooms and costumery.
"That one," Richard said at last, pointing. "So, they're fleeking the Hollander," said the impresario. "Never would have pegged you for that one, guy."
He helped Richard to put on the 17th-century garb, which included a rich black doublet with slashed sleeves and a wide lace collar, black breeches, funnel-top boots that folded over a short cape, and a wide-brimmed hat with a black plume.
"By damn, that's more like it," Stein whacked Richard on the back. "You make a pretty good pirate. So that's what you're like deep down inside, huh? A regular fucking Blackbeard?"
"Black mustache," said Voorhees. He collapsed, out cold.
Stein paid off the impresario, flew them back to the darkened café to transfer Richard's luggage from the rented egg, and then hopped it for L'Auberge du Portal. By the time they got there, the ex-spacer had revived.
"Let's have another drink," Stein suggested. "Try my eau de vie."
Richard took a swallow of the raw spirit.
"Not much bouquet, but considerable authority."
The two costumed roisterers went singing through the rose garden and pounded on the oaken door of the inn with the blunt side of Stein's battle axe. The staff responded, unperturbed. They were used to having clients arrive in a more or less fuddled condition. 6 powerful attendants took charge of the Viking and black mustache, and in no time at all, they were snoring between lavender-scented sheets. 12. Felice Landry and the psychosocial counselor strolled into the flagged courtyard of the auberge, down an open passage and into an office that looked out at the fountain and flowers. The room had been copied from the study of a 15th-century abbess. The stone fireplace, with its bogus coat of arms and a huge bouquet of scarlet gladioli, fanned between dog-headed andirons.
"You've come such a long way, Citizen Landry," said the counselor. "It's a pity that your application has encountered such difficulties."
He leaned back in the carved chair, forming a church and steeple with his fingers. He had a pointed nose, a perpetual half-smile, and tightly curled black hair with a flashy white blaze in front. His eyes were wary. He had read her profile. Still, she looked docile enough in that gray-blue gown, twisting her poor little fingers in anxiety. Kindly, he said,
"You see, Felice, you're really very young to be contemplating such a serious step. As you may know, the first custodian of the time portal," he nodded to an oil portrait of the sainted Madame that hung above the fireplace, "set a minimum age of 28 years for her clients. Now, we may agree today that Angélique Goudrion's restriction was arbitrary based upon antiquated Thomistic notions of psychomaturation, but nevertheless, the basic principle does remain quite valid. Fully formed judgment is essential for life and death decisions, and you are 18, I'm sure. You are far more mature than most persons of your age, but nevertheless, it would be prudent to wait a few more years before opting for exile. There is no return, Felice."
"I am harmless and afraid and small. I am in your power, and I need your help so badly and would be so grateful. You've studied my profile, Counselor Schankweiler. I'm rather a mess."
"Yes, yes, but that can be treated, citizen." He leaned forward and took her cool hand. "We have so many more facilities here on Earth than were available on your home planet. Arcady is so remote, it's hardly to be expected that the counselors out there would have the latest therapy techniques. But you could go to Vienna, or New York, or Wuhan, and the top people would certainly be able to smooth out your little SM problem and the male envious hyperaggression. There would be only the smallest bit of personality derangement. You would be quite good as new when the course of treatment was finished."
The melting and submissive brown eyes began to brim up.
"I'm sure you have only my best interests at heart, Counselor Schankweiler, but you must try to understand. Pity, aid, empathize, condescend to help the pathetic little one. I prefer to remain the way I am. That's why I've refused treatment. The thought of other persons manipulating my mind, changing it, fills me with the most dreadful fear. I just couldn't permit it." "I wouldn't permit it."
The counselor moistened his lips and suddenly realized that he was stroking her hand. He gave a start, dropped it, and said,
"Well, your psychosocial problems wouldn't ordinarily preclude transfer into exile, but besides your youth, there is the second matter. As you are aware, the Consilium does not permit persons having operant metapsychic powers to pass into exile. They are too valuable to the milieu. Now, your tests show that you are possessed of latent metafunctions with coercive psychokinetic and psychocreative potentials of extremely high magnitude. No doubt these were partly responsible for your success as a professional athlete."
She showed a smile of regret, then slowly dropped her head so that the now limp platinum hair curtained her face.
"That's all over now. They wouldn't have me any longer."
"Quite so," said Schankweiler. "But if your psychosocial problems were successfully dealt with, it might be possible for the people at the MP Institute to bring up your latent abilities to operant status.
Think what that would mean. You would become one of the elite of the milieu. A person of vast influence, a literal world-shaker. What a noble career you might have, spending yourself in service to a grateful galaxy. You might even aspire to a role in the Consilium."
"Oh, I could never think of doing that. It's frightening to think of all those minds. Besides, I could never give up being what I am. There must be a way for me to pass through the time portal, even if I am underage. You must help me find the way, Counselor."
He hesitated.
"The recidivist clause might have been invoked if the unfortunate McSweeney and Barstow had elected to press charges. There is no age restriction for recidivists."
"I should have thought of that myself."
Her smile of relief was dazzling.
"Then it's all so simple."
She rose and came around to Schankweiler's side of the desk. Still smiling, she took both his shoulders in her cool little hands, pressed with the thumbs, and snapped his collarbones. 13. Cicadas buzzed in the branches of the old plane trees that shaded the dining terrace. The scent of mignonette distilled from the gardens in the noontime heat and mingled with the perfume of the roses. Elizabeth Orne toyed with her fruit salad and drank minted iced tea, while she marveled over the list that slowly glided over the surface of the plaque book before her.
"Will you listen to these vocations, Aiken? Architect, daub and wattle. Architect, log. Architect, unmortared stone. Bamboo artificer. I didn't know bamboo grew in Europe during the Pliocene. Baker, balloonist, basket maker, beekeeper, brewer, candle and rushlight maker, ceramicist, charcoal burner, cheesemaker, dompteur, ooze. What in the world is that, do you suppose?" Aiken Drum's black eyes flashed. He leapt to his feet, reddish gollywog hair a bristle, and cracked an imaginary whip.
"Ha! Saber-tooth kitty cat! Down, sirrah! So you defy the commands of your master? Roll over! Thatch! Not the ringmaster, you fucking fool!"
Several of the nearby lunchers gawked. Elizabeth laughed. "Of course! Wild animal tamers would be very useful in the Pliocene. Some of those large antelopes and things would be valuable if they could be domesticated. Still, I wouldn't want to tackle a mastodon or a rhino on the strength of a quickie sleep course in the art."
"Oh, the people here will do better than that for you, Candy Doll. What happens is, you sleep soak a very basic education in Neolithic technology and general survival. Then you'll at least have the wits to dig a latrine that won't swallow you whole, and you'll know what Pliocene fruits aren't going to send you pushing up the daisies. After you sop up the basics, you pick one or more of the japes on that little list to specialize in. They give you a detailed sleeper on it, and lab work, and reference plaques for the tricky bits."
"Hmm," she mused.
"I imagine they try to steer you into a field that isn't already overcrowded. I mean, folks on the other side of the gate would be apt to get testy if you sent them 83 lutenists and a taffy puller when what they really wanted was somebody who knew how to make soap."
"You know, that's not really so funny, Aiken. If there's any kind of organized society on the other side, they'd be entirely dependent on the gate operators to send suitably trained people. Because the women timefarers are sterile, there'd be no young apprentices to replace workers who died or just wandered away. If your settlement lost its cheesemaker, you'd just have to eat crud and whey until another one popped through the gate."
Drum finished his iced tea and began to chew the cubes.
"Things can't be too shabby in exile. People have been going through since 2041. The vocational guidance thing hasn't been perking for anything like that long. Just the last 4 years or so, but the older inmates of the Nutloft must have got something going." He thought for a minute. "Figure that most of the ones who went through were macro-immune and maybe even rejuvenated, since that was perfected in the early 40s. Barring the expected attrition from accidents, getting eaten by monsters, emigration to the Pliocene antipodes, or just plain human bloody-mindedness, there ought to be quite a crowd still knocking around. 80, 90 thou easy. And like as not with a barter-style economy operating. Most of the time travelers were damn intelligent."
"And crackers," said Elizabeth Orme. "Even as thee and me." She made an unobtrusive gesture toward an adjoining table where a great blonde man in a Viking outfit drank beer with a saturnine, well-used wayfarer in floppy sea boots and a ruffled black shirt. Aiken rolled his eyeballs, looking more gnomish than ever.
"Do you think that's weird? Wait till you see my rig out, lovey."
"Don't tell me. A Highland lad with bagpipe and tartan and a sporran full of exploding joints?"
"Pissy patoot, woman. You certainly were telling the truth when you said your mind-reading powers were washed up."
Don't plead with me.
It's going to be a big surprise. What I will tell you now is my chosen vocation for the land of no return. I am going to be a jack of all trades. Scottish-style Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. And how about you, my beautiful burned-out brain-bender?"
Elizabeth's smile was dreamy.
"I don't think I'll take on a new persona. I'll just stay me, maybe in red denim, and wear my far-speaker's ring with one of Blessed Elusia's diamonds in remembrance of past times. As for the vocation..."
She speeded up the book so that the list of occupations raced past, then turned back to the beginning, her brow furrowed in concentration.
"I'll need more than one trade. Basket maker, charcoal burner, tanner. Put them all together,
Add one more that begins with a B, and guess my new profession, Akendrum.
Bull's a brass woman, he howled, slapped a hand on the table delightedly. The Viking and the pirate stared in mild surprise. A balloonist! Oh, you lovely lady, you'll soar again in one way or another, won't you, Elizabeth?
There was a soft chime. A disembodied woman's voice said, Candidates in Group Green, we would be most pleased if you would join Councillor Mishima in the Petit Salon, where a most interesting orientation program has been arranged for you. Candidates in Group Yellow.
Green, that's us, said Aiken.
The pair of them drifted into the main building of the inn, all whitewashed stone, dark, heavy beams, and priceless objects of art. The Petit Salon was a cozy, air-conditioned chamber, furnished with brocaded armchairs, fantastically carved armoires, and a faded tapestry of a virgin and her unicorn. This was the first time that the group, which was destined to pass through the time portal in a body after 5 days' training, had come together. Elizabeth studied her fellow misfits, and tried to guess what exigencies had driven them to choose exile. Waiting for them, in the otherwise empty room, was a lovely pale-haired child in a simple black chongsam. Her chair was separated from the others by a couple of meters. One of her slender wrists was fastened to the heavy chair arm by a delicate silver chain. The pirates and the Viking glanced in, looking bashful and truculent because nobody else was yet in costume. They clumped forward and sat down precisely in the center of the row of seats. Another pair that seemed acquainted entered without speaking. A milkmaid hale woman with curly brown hair, wearing a white coverall, and a stocky man who appeared to be middle-aged, having a snub nose, Slavic cheekbones, and corded hairy forearms that looked able to throttle an ox. A quasi-academic personage in an antique Harris jacket arrived last of all, carrying a briefcase. He looked so self-possessed that Elizabeth found it impossible to imagine what his problem might be. Councillor Mishima, tall and sleek, came in beaming and nodding. He expressed his delight at their presence, and hoped they would enjoy the introduction to Pliocene geography and ecology that he was pleased to present at this time.
We have among us a distinguished person far more knowledgeable in paleoecology than I, the councillor said, bowing low to the Slavic type. I would appreciate his interrupting me should my little lecture require correction or embellishment.
Well, that explains him, Elizabeth thought. A retired paleontologist bent on touring the fossil zoo, and the dolly on the leash is a recidivist wacko, a few stripes blacker than poor Aiken, no doubt. The boys in fancy dress are your obvious anachronistic losers. But who is the white lady, and the thinking man who wears tweeds in August? The room light faded, and the tapestry rose to reveal a large holograph screen. There was music. Lord Jesus, thought Elizabeth, not Stravinsky. The screen went from black to living tri-D color in an orbiter's view of Pliocene Earth, 6 million years, give or take a few, backward in time. In a long shot, it looked pretty familiar, but then the lens zoomed in. Mishima said,
The continents, you will observe, are in their approximate modern positions. However, their outlines have an unfamiliar aspect, primarily because shallow epicontinental seas still covered some areas, while others, now lying underwater, were then dry land.
The globe rotated slowly and stopped when Europe was well positioned. The lens zoomed in closer and closer.
You will all be furnished with a set of durofilm maps, small scale for the entire Lower Pliocene Earth, 1 to 7 million of Europe and 1 to 1 million of France. Should you plan an excursion to other parts of the world or simply have an interest in them, we will do our utmost to provide you with suitable maps or marine charts.
How accurate will they be? Asked the pirate.
Extremely so, we believe. Mishima's response was smooth. The Pliocene being one of the most recent geological epochs, our computers have been able to map its topography with an accuracy that must approach 82%. The areas most speculatively derived include fine details of the littoral minor watercourses and certain aspects of the Mediterranean basin. He began to show them close-up views of different areas, all in vivid relief, and supplemented by an outline overlay of the modern landform.
The British Isles are fused into a single very large mass, Albion, which is probably joined by a narrow isthmus to Normandy. The Lowcountry area is submerged by the Anversian Sea, as is northwestern Germany. Fennoscandia is an unbroken unit, as yet unsundered by the Baltic. Poland and Russia are strewn with swamps and lakes, some quite large. Another great body of fresh water lies southwest of the Vosges in France, and there are large alpine lakes. To the east, the land looked almost completely unfamiliar. A brackish lagoon, the Pannonian Basin, covered Hungary, and drained through the Iron Gate and the Dacian Strait to a shallow remnant of the once dominant Tethys Sea, also called Loch Mare. This spread swampy lagoons and salt water far into Central Asia and northward to the iceless boreal ocean. In years to come, only the Aral and the Caspian Seas would remain as souvenirs of the vanished Tethys. Note also that the Euxinic Basin, which will someday become the Black Sea, is also fresh water. It is fed by the towering ranges of Caucasia, Anatolia, and the Helvetides to the west. A vast swamp occupies the area of the modern Sea of Marmara. Below this is Lake Levant, roughly corresponding to the Aegean Sea of today.
The med looks pretty mixed up to me, the Viking observed. In my line of work, I had to know something about the crazy geology of that region. It seems to me you got to be doing a whole lot of guessing to come up with that layout there.
Mishima acknowledged the point. There are problems connected with the chronology of the successive Mediterranean inundations. We believe this configuration is most plausible for the early Pliocene. Please observe that the now vanished peninsula of Balearis juts eastward from Spain. There is a single narrow island in place of modern Corse and Sardinia. Italy during that time has only its Apennine spine above sea level, together with an unstable southern area called Tyrrhenus, which once was much larger but now is sinking. He gave them a closer view of Western Europe. This is the region that should be of immediate interest to you. The Rhone-Saône trough contains a great river, draining swamps north of Switzerland and the large Loch de Bresse. The lower Rhone valley of Pliocene times was probably invaded by the Mediterranean. Many of the volcanoes in the Massif Central were active, and there was also volcanism in Germany, Spain, central Italy, and in the subsiding Tyrrhenian area. Farther north in France, we see that Brittany is an island separated from the mainland by the narrow Strait of Redon. The Atlantic forms a deep embayment southward into Anjou. Part of Gascony is also inundated by the sea.
But Bordeaux seems to be all right, thank God, said the pirate.
Mishima chuckled.
Ah, another connoisseur! You will be delighted to know, citizen, that a number of other timefarers expressed a wish to settle in the Bordeaux area. They have carried with them certain portable apparatus and cuttings of many different grapes. Incidentally, citizens, such information as we have about these earlier time travelers is available from our computer at your convenience. And if you wish to have other information, for example, data on religious or ethnic groups or on the kinds of books, art material, or other cultural items known to have been translated, please do not hesitate to request it.
The academic type in the tweed jacket asked,
Will the computer give information on individual persons?
Aha, thought Elizabeth.
The usual statistics, similar to those in your own dossiers, are available on those persons who have already passed through. It is also possible to obtain information on the items taken as baggage and the traveler's destination in the Pliocene world, if stated.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, Mishima nodded to Felice, who had raised a languid hand.
Is it true that none of these travelers took any weapons with them?
No modern weapons were allowed by Madame Gaudrian, and we have followed her wise dictum. No zappers, no stun guns, no atomics, no sonic disruptors, no solar-powered blasters, no gases, no gunpowder-based weapons. No psycho-coercive drugs or devices. However, many kinds of primitive weaponry from different eras and cultures have been taken into the Pliocene.
Landry nodded. Her face was void of expression. Elizabeth tried, without realizing what she was doing, to throw a redactive probe into her, but of course it was useless. Nevertheless, the ex-metapsychic was amazed when the young woman turned her head and stared directly at her for a long minute before looking back at the screen. She couldn't have felt anything, Elizabeth told herself. There was nothing to feel. And even if the carrier went out, there's no way she could have known that it was me. Was there? Councillor Mishima said,
Let us briefly note some of the names that have been given to the geographical features. Then we will survey the plant and animal life of the so-called Pontian facies of Lower Pliocene times.
14. Just as soon as the lecture ended, Grenfell hurried to his room and the computer terminal, which was housed in a Renaissance credence of wormy fruitwood. He requested the data in permanent durofilm sheets, not really knowing what to expect. What did emerge was pathetically meager. But it unexpectedly included a full-length color portrait, probably taken just prior to her passing through the gate. Merci Lombard was wearing a cowled cloak of deep reddish-brown that concealed most of her auburn hair and made dark pits of her eyes. Her face was white and strained. The dress was long, simply cut, of Nile green with a trimming of gold embroidery about the neck, wrists, and hem. Her narrow waist was held in a girdle of some dark color, from which hung a purse and a small scabbard with unidentifiable instruments in it. She wore gold bracelets and a gold necklace, both with purple stones. A large brocaded valise sat beside her. She carried a covered basket and a leather case that looked as though it held a small harp. She was accompanied by a huge white dog, wearing a spiked collar and four sheep. He stared at the picture for some time, memorizing it, while his eyes stung. Then he read her tersely summarized dossier. Lombard, Mercedes Chiffon, 8-049-333-032-421-F. Born, Sombriac, 48-31 North, 02-45 West, France, Europa, Sol 3, Earth, 15-5-2082. Daughter, George Bradford Lombard, 3-946-202-664-117. And Siobhan Maeve O'Connell, 3-429-697-551-418. Siblings, 0. Marriages, 0. Divorces, 0. Children, 0. Physique, height, 170 centimeters. Weight, 46 kilograms. Skin, fair, 1. Hair, red, 2. Eyes, green, 4. Distinctive markings, mole, rescapula. Mental SA, 1A plus 146, pren, plus 3B2, end pren. PSA, plus 5, plus 4.2, plus 3.0, 0.7, plus 6.1. Metapsychic quotient, 0.079 latent, plus 28, plus 6, plus 133, plus 468, plus 1. Medical history, NSI, NST, NSS, supplement 1. Psychiatric history. Alien reference 4, non-disabling, fugue 5, non-disabling, MDIP 2, pren, 0.25 DISUT, supplement 2. Education, BA Paris 2102, MA Anthropology, Oxford 2103, PhD French Medieval History, Paris 2104, DLH Celtic Studies, Dublin 2105. Employment, immersive pageant, air, pren, T4, T1, close pren, 05 through 08. Assistant Director, 3-2, 08 through 09. Immersive Pageant, France. Assistant Director, 0910. Residence, 25A, Habitat Saint-Rion, 4554 North, 0307 East, France, Europa, Sol 3. Civic Status, Star 1, Star A, 0010. Credit Rating, A-013. Licenses, Egg 3, Telecom, Transport Ground, Electronic 1, Tech 2, Dog. Remarks, Entrance, 10-5-2110. Vocational Options, Dyer, Sheep Husbandry, Smallholder, Weaver, Wool Tech. Persinv, Supplement 3, Destination, NS, Attachment, NS. Date of Temporal Translation, 15-5-2110. Reference, J.D. Evans, G.C. 2. Supplement 3. Personal Inventory, Lombard, M.S. Clothing. Gown, silk, green, embroidered gold. Gown, silk with embroidery and green. Gown, pulchro, black embroidery. silver mylar, scarves, silk, 3. Cloak, repiva, terracotta. Smalls, silk, assorted with 3 STSs. Hose, silk, with 3 pair. Shoes, low leather, 2 pair. Belt, leather, purse, leather. Chatelaine leather plus scissors, knife, file, comb, stylus, fork, spoon. Baggage. Survival unit, A6 star. Small holder unit, F1 star. Sheep kit, OV, 1 star. Fleck, music, 5KU with AVP, supplement 4. Fleck library, 10KU with AVP, supplement 5. Decimal appliance, spin wheel, hand spindle, carder, loom, L4H, dye tub, valise, leather brocade. Basket Espardo, covered, necklace, gold and amethyst, bracelets, gold and amethyst, 3, ring, gold and pearl, mirror, silver, 10 centimeters, note plaque, 1KU, soak it, S1 star, harp, gilt carved sycamore wood, Celtic with case, leather, harp strings and pegs, assorted spare, fife, open, silver, plants, strawberry, Auvoir Supérieur 12E, 100 PTSs. Hemp. Cannabis. S. Sensimilla. 15 CTGSs. Culinary herb unit. CH1 star. Small grain unit. SG1 star. Miscellaneous seed packets. Bluebell. Campanula biliardi. Indigo. Indigofera tincturia. Madder. Rubia tinctorum. P. Mange 2. Animals. Chien de Pyrenees. Bideres Vidra Stella Polaris. 1 female, pregnant, 4 male, plus 4 female. Sheep. Rambouillet, Debouillet. 3 female, at, pregnant, 2 female, 1 male. There was more. The supplements with details of her medical and psychiatric history. The library supplements listing her music and books. He skimmed these, then returned to the poignant inventory and the portrait. Will I find you again, Mercy? In your silken gown and golden jewelry? With your harp and your fife and your strawberries and bluebells? Where will you go to tend your pregnant sheep? Destination, N.S. Will I find you alone? Except for loyal Deirdre and her pups, as you've always lived? Attachment, N.S. Will you welcome me and teach me the songs of old Languedoc or old Ireland? Or will your heart's wound still be too deep for me to fill? MDEP 2.25 This UT. What did you find on the other side of the time portal when you stepped through on your birthday, beginning your 29th year of life, 6 million years before you were born? And why am I leaving this bravest of all new worlds for a constricting unknown? What's in the dark that I'm so afraid of finding, not finding? Beguiled my heart, I know not why, and yet I love her till I die. 15. Claude Majeski opened his eyes, wiped the room out of them with a tissue, and removed the earplug that had been teaching him while he slapped out a mortise wind beams into the rafters of a log cabin. His left arm was full of pins and needles, and his feet were cold. Damn crocky old circulation shot to hell. As he needed the blood back into the muscles, he reflected that he would miss the luxury of the auberge's goose-down pillows, liquicel mattress, and real muslin sheets. He hoped the survival kit they would test today had a decent camp bed. He padded across the sunny room to the bath. Here, the compassion of Madame Gudrian was made manifest in black-and-white marble and golden plumbing, in thick towels, perfumed soap and toiletries by Chanel, in sauna and sun lamp, and the masseuse ready to cradle the clients of the inn in soothing elegance after sobering lessons in La Vie Sauvage. Some poor timefarers, struggling to endure the Pliocene world, would remember the last days at the auberge for French cooking, soft beds, and precious works of art. But Majeski knew that his fondest memories would be of the sybaritic John, the warm, padded seat that welcomed his spindly shanks, the tissue like perforated rabbit fur. He harked back to some of the primitive conveniences he and Jen had suffered on boondock planets, porticans with broken heating units, noisome stone and wood tilly houses full of lurking critters, rough two-holers over flooded trenches, even one ghastly night of storms on Lusatia, when he had squatted on a log and then discovered that it harbored little mighty monstrosities. Oh, blessed sanitary plumbing. If no one else invented a Pliocene water closet, Claude intended to give it an earnest shot. He had a cool, perfumed shower, cleaned his teeth, third set, good as new, made a face at himself in the Louis XIV mirror. Not too decrepit. A casual appraisal might judge his age to be late 50-ish. He was vain about his Polish green eyes and striking thatch of waved silver hair, the result of having the male pattern baldness codons erased from his genetic heritage on the last rejuve. But thank God he'd depilated the rest of his pelt. Characters like that pirate, who prized facial hair, might have another song to sing in a primitive world, especially a warm and buggy one like Pontian Europe. The old paleobiologist had noted with grim humor that yesterday's lectures and clever animated movies on Pliocene ecology had barely mentioned the insects and other invertebrate denizens. It was more dramatic to show vast herds of hipparians and graceful gazelles being harried by scarcely less graceful cheetahs, or machairodont lions sinking their long canines into bellowing hoe-tuskers. Claude went back into the bedroom and asked room service to send coffee and croissants. Since the second day was to feature simple survival techniques, he put on the clothing he planned to wear through the gate. Experience had made his choice of kit easy. Fishnet underwear, old-fashioned bush shirt and pants made of the best Egyptian long-staple cotton, socks of Orcadian wool with fat left in, and indestructible boots from Etruria. He had brought along his old backpack, even though the auberge stood ready to furnish all equipment. It contained his poncho of breathable gritless skin and an Orcadian sweater. And in one zip compartment was a beautiful zakopane box, all carved and ornamented wood. Jen's box. It hardly weighed a thing. As he breakfasted, he studied the program for the day's activities. Introduction to Survival Unit A6 Star, Shelter and Fire. Minimizing Environmental Hazards. Ho-ho. Orienteering, fishing and trapping. He sighed, drank the perfect coffee, and munched a flaky bread roll. It was going to be a long day. 16. Sister Anna Maria Recaro had done a fair bit of camping, but the expensive new decimal equipment contained in Unit A6 was a delight and a revelation to her. She and the other members of Group Green had first gone to class, where a hearty woman instructor briefed them. Then they had paired up and descended to a cavern, carved out of the living rock 200 meters below the cellars of the auberge. They were let loose into a sunny meadow with a winding stream, and told to become acquainted with their survival gear. The simulated sun felt hot, even though the reset of their body thermostats was progressing apace. After she and Felice had hiked a short distance, Amory decided that she would have to forego the sandals that had been her first choice for Pliocene footgear. They were suitably monastic and airy, but they also admitted twigs and small stones. Short buskins or even modern boots would be better for cross-country travel. She also decided that the white doe-skin habit was overwarm, even with detachable sleeves. Homespun would be better. She could have a doe-skin scapula, cowl, and cloak to keep off the weather. "Aren't you hot in that outfit, Felice?" she asked her companion. Landry was wearing the green and black ring hockey uniform, which was evidently her choice for the Pliocene. "It suits me," the girl said. "I'm used to working in it. And my planet was much warmer than Earth. That doe-skin looks very high priestess, Emery. I like it." The nun felt strangely flustered. Felice looked so incongruous in her warrior's cuirass and greaves, and that Grecian helm with its brave green feathers perched on the back of her head. Stein and Richard had started to tease her when she appeared in the costume that morning, but for some reason they had broken off almost immediately. "Shall we camp here?" the nun suggested. A large cork oak grew beside the brook, shading a flat surface that looked like a good place to set up the cabin. The two women shed their packs, and Amory extracted the fist-sized inflator from hers and studied it. Their instructor had said that the sealed power supply would be good for about 20 years. "Here are two nozzles, one to blow things up and the other to deflate. It says, imperative to sheathe unused nozzle." "Try my cabin pack." Felice held out a wad about the size of a sandwich. "I can't believe it'll grow into a 4x4 house. Sister Recaro fixed the dangling flat tube of the pack to the inflator, then pressed the activating stud. Compressed air began to spurt into the wand, turning it into a large, silvery square. The two women positioned the cabin properly, then watched it grow. The floor thickened to about 9 centimeters and became quite rigid as air filled the complex micropore structural web between the layers of film. The walls, somewhat thicker for insulation, grew up, complete with transparent, zippable windows and interior screen curtains. A steeply gabled silvery roof that overhung the doorway inflated last of all. Felice peered inside the doorless entry.
Look! The floor has sprouted fixed furniture!
There were bunks for two, with semi-detached pillows, a table, shelves, and at the rear, a silvery box with a pipe leading to the roof. Felice read aloud,
"Ballast stove with sand or unit will compress upon cooling."
This material must be nearly impossible to destroy. She reached behind her left greave and produced a glittering little gold-handled dirk.
Can't puncture it either.
What a pity they've made it to degrade in 20 years. Still, we should be at one with our environment by then. Large bucket-shaped hollows in each corner of the cabin had to be ballasted with stones, earth, water, or whatever else was to hand. A very small pocket near the door yielded up a whole handful of pill-sized wads that were to be inflated separately, then weighted with sand or with water. The latter could be injected into the interstitial area by means of a simple collapsible bulb siphon. The pills grew into a cabin door, chairs, cooking gear, with the sand ballast note, filamentous rugs and blankets, and other miscellany. Less than 10 minutes after they had begun to set up camp, the women were relaxing in a fully equipped cabin.
I can hardly believe it, Sister Recaro marveled, rapping on the walls. It feels quite solid. But if there were any wind, the whole cabin would blow away like a bubble unless you weighted it down.
Even wood is mostly thin air and water, said Felice with a shrug. This decamol just seems to reproduce the structurally reinforced shell of a thing and let you add mass. Wonder how the stuff compensates for heat and pressure changes. Some kind of valves, I suppose. You'd obviously have to guide this house in a high wind, though, even if you filled most of the wall hollows with water or dirt. But it sure beats a tent. It even has ventilators.
Shall we inflate the boat, or the mini-shelter, or the bridge sections?
They were optional. Now that I've seen how decamol works, I'll take the rest of the equipment on faith.
Felice crossed her legs and pulled off her gauntlets slowly. She was seated at the small table.
Faith, that's your game, isn't it?
The nun sat down. In a way. Technically, I intend to become an anchoress, a kind of religious hermit. It's a calling that's completely obsolete in the milieu, but it used to have its fans in the Dark Ages.
What in the world will you be doing, just praying up a storm all day long?
Amory laughed.
Part of the night, too.
I intend to bring back the Latin Divine Office. It's an ancient cycle of daily prayers. Matin starts it off at midnight, then there's lauds at dawn. During the daytime, there are prayers for the old 1st, 3rd, 6th, and 9th hours, then vespers or evensong at sunset, and compline before going to bed. The office is a collection of psalms and scripture readings and hymns and special prayers that reflected centuries of religious tradition. I think it's a terrible pity that no one prays it anymore in the primitive form.
And you just keep saying this office all the time?
Good grief, no. The individual hours aren't that long. I'll also celebrate the Mass and do penance and deep meditation with a little Zen. And when I'm hoeing weeds or doing other chores, there's the rosary. It's almost like a mantra if you do it the old way. Very calming. Felice stared at her with well-deep eyes.
It sounds very strange.
And lonely, too. Doesn't it frighten you, planning to live all alone with nobody but your God? Dear old Claude says he'll maintain me in style, but I'm not too sure I can take him seriously. If he does supply me with some food, I may be able to handcraft some items in my spare time that we can barter.
Claude? Landry was contemptuous. He's been around, that old man. He's not a complete case like those two machos in fancy dress, but I caught him looking at me in a fishy way.
You can't blame him for looking at you. You're very beautiful. I've heard you were a great sports star on your homeworld. The girl's lip curled in a grim little smile.
Akari, I was the best ring hockey player of all time. But they were afraid of me. In the end, the other players, the men, refused to come up against me. They made all kinds of trouble. Finally, I was barred from the game when two players claimed I had deliberately tried to do them serious injury.
Had you? Felice lowered her gaze. She was twisting the fingers of her gloves, and a flush was rising from her neck into her cheeks.
Maybe. I think I did. They were so hateful.
She raised her pointed chin in defiance. The hoplite helmet pushed to the back of her head, giving her the look of a miniature Pallas Athene.
They never wanted me as a woman, you know. All they wanted was to hurt me, to spoil me. They were jealous of my strength and afraid. People have always been afraid of me. Even when I was just a child. Can you imagine what that was like?
Oh, Felice, Amory hesitated. How did you ever begin playing that brutal game?
I was good with animals. My parents were soil scientists, and they were always moving around on field expeditions. Newly opened lands, still full of wildlife. When the local kids in the area would snub me, I'd just get myself some pets for friends. Small creatures at first, then larger, and more dangerous kinds. And there were some beauties on Arcady, I can tell you. Finally, when I was 15, I tamed a varal. It's something like a very large earth rhinoceros. A local animal dealer wanted to buy him for ring hockey training. I'd never paid much attention to the game before, but I did, after I sold the beast. I woke up to the fact that there was a big money business that might be perfect for my special talents.
But to break into a professional sport when you were only a young girl...
I told my parents I wanted to become an apprentice varal trainer and groom. They didn't mind. I'd always been excess baggage. They just made me finish school and let me go. They said, be happy, baby.
She paused and stared at Amory without expression.
I was a groom only until the team manager saw how I could control the animals. That's the secret of playing the game, you see. The varal has to make the goals and maneuver to keep you from getting stunned by the short-range weapons the players carry.
I played in the preseason, as a novelty, to give the Greenhammer box office a hype. The team had been in the cellar for 3 years running. When they saw that I was more than a publicity gimmick, they put me onto the first string in the season opener. I whipped the other clowns on the team into such a froth trying to outdo me that we won the bloody game, and all the rest, and the pennant, too.
Wonderful. It should have been, but I had no friends. I was too different from the rest of the players, too freakish. And in the second year, when they really began to hate me, and I knew they would force me out, I...
She pounded both fists on the table, and her child's face twisted in anguish. Amory waited for the tears, but there were none. The briefly revealed hurt was masked almost as soon as it had showed itself. Sitting across the table, Felice relaxed, smiling at the other woman.
I'm going to be a huntress, you know, on the other side. I could take care of you much better than the old man, Amory.
The nun rose up, blood pounding in her temples. She turned away from Felice and walked out of the cabin.
I think we need each other, the girl said.
17.
Auberge du Portal, France, Europa, Earth. 24 August, 2110. My dear Varya, we have completed our little games of survival and craftsmanship now, and our bodies are fully acclimated to the tropical world that was Pliocene Earth. There remain only a last supper and a good night's sleep before passage through the time portal at dawn. The apparatus is inside a quaint cottage in the gardens of the auberge, and you can't imagine a more incongruous sight for the gate into another world. One looks in vain for the sign above the doorway saying, Permessi vatra la perduta gente, but the feeling is there all the same. After 5 days of working together, more like a holiday camp than basic training, you must understand, the eight of us in Group Green have achieved shaky competence in our chosen fields of primitive technology, and a faith in our ability to cope that is probably dangerously inflated. Few of the others seem to appreciate the potential hazard that we might face from our predecessors into exile. My fellow greenies are more inclined to worry about being stamped upon by mammoths or bitten by python-sized vipers than to anticipate a hostile human reception committee greedily awaiting the day's grab bag of well-heeled wayfarers.
You and I know that the Time Gate arrivals would certainly have been ritualized in some manner by the people on the other side. What the ritual will be is another matter. We can hardly expect to be treated as casual commuters. But whether we shall encounter welcome or exploitation is impossible to fathom. Literature offers certain speculative scenarios that make my flesh crawl. Personnel at the Auberge are careful to present a neutral face, while at the same time reinforcing our childhood self-defensive training. We will pass through the portal in two groups of four persons, with larger pieces of baggage following. This, I feel, is designed to give us a certain safety in numbers, although the momentary pain and disorientation of ordinary subspace translation will probably affect time travelers as well, putting us at a tactical disadvantage for the first minute following our arrival in the Pliocene. Your amused speculations upon my new vocation in the primitive world were much appreciated. However, since the last dinosaurs perished at least 60 million years before the Pliocene epoch, there will be little call for sweeping up after them. So much for your visions of me as an antediluvian fertilizer tycoon. Prosaically enough, my new job is to be little more than an extension of my erstwhile hobby of sailing. I shall fish for a living, and ply the seas on my quest, and perhaps undertake the odd bit of trade if the occasion presents. The sloop was far too sophisticated a vessel to take to the Pliocene, so I traded her in for a smaller trimaran that can be ballasted with water and sand instead of mercury. If need be, I can whip up a very simple craft from scratch materials as well. We are furnished with tool heads of a gem-like glassy material, vitrodur, which stays ever sharp and is virtually indestructible for some 200 years, after which it degrades like decimal. Besides the shipwright's kit, I am equipped with the Auberge's survival gear, very impressive, and what they call a small holder unit, tools and decimal appliances for setting up light housekeeping on a subsistence farm, together with a few packets of seeds and a large fleck library with a raft of how-to books on every subject from animal husbandry to zymergy. The latter, by the way, is the vocation of choice for our Viking. He also confided to me that if there should be a demand for swashbuckling mercenary warriors, he might combine the two trades. The individual whom I dubbed the pirate also plans to get involved with alcoholic beverages, wines and brandies, that is. He and the Viking are now the straightest of friends, spending their off hours tossing down the most expensive spirits that the Auberge can supply, and speculating on the quality of female consolation that might be available in the by-and-by. Group Green itself has lean pickings. Besides the nun, our female members include a sinister virgin huntress who seems to have wreaked mayhem or worse on one of the Auberge counselors in order to qualify as a recidivist, and an extremely cautious ex-meta lady who is, at the moment at least, content to remain just one of the boys. Last night we had a fascinating glimpse into the background of the pirate. His brother and sister turned up unexpectedly to say adieu, and turned out to be fleetline officers of the most impressive stripe. The poor P was very discomfited, and the ex-meta lady speculates that he must be a cashiered spacer himself. He's a competent sort if you don't mind grouches. I worked with him for a few hours in the small boat handling exercise, which he wanted to cram, and he seemed to have a natural flair for messing about in the water. Most of the others in Group Green seem to be alone in the world. The nun received a long conference call from her religious sistren in North America bidding her bon voyage, and earlier today she met with a Franciscan brother in full conventual fig, no doubt hearing her last confession or whatever. The friar drove one of those souped-up Gambini eggs with the heat dissipation fins, not the patient gray donkey you might have anticipated from Memoirs of Il Poverello. The nun was a medic and psychological counselor by profession and plans to retire to a hermitage. I hope the poor woman isn't counting on ministering angels such as the old paleontologist overmuch. He's a fine chap with a penchant for carpentry, but I dare say the ex-meta is right when she pegs him as a death-wisher. I concur with your analysis of the little joker. There must have been some valid square-peg reason for him to be thrown off his home world, but it's a pity that his wild talents couldn't be harnessed for the milieu. Poor little non-born. He's endeared himself to the rest of us greenies, not only for his ghastly sense of humor, but also for his fantastic ability to make something out of nothing. He has assembled a large collection of Vitrador tool heads that need only be equipped with shafts or handles to be operational. You get the feeling that after this boy has been in the Pliocene for a week or two, the Industrial Revolution will be raging. He has a whole forge lash up in Decamol for his village blacksmith and rustic mechanician acts, and has acquired a plaqueful of geological survey charts to clue him in on metal ores, in the unlikely event that none of the other exiles has gone in heavy for prospecting. He may be interested in the peculiar social structure of Group Green. The foundress of the auberge was a practical psychologist of no mean ability and realized quite early on that her clients would need support from fellow travelers in order to maximize survival potential beyond the gate. On the other hand, they would tend to be far too eccentric to stand for any of the more obvious schemes of imposed organization. So, Madame Goudrion fell back on the old put-em-through-hell-together-and-they'll-end-up-buddy shtick, which, she must admit, is apt to induce feelings of solidarity in all but the most sociopathic. And it did, too, with the obvious exception. During each day's group activities, we have spent the most strenuous sessions working together, often thrust into outlandish situations where we were forced to cooperate with one another in order to complete a difficult task quickly and well. For example, we bridged a 30-meter pond full of alligators in one lesson, captured, butchered, and utilized an elk in another, and defended ourselves against hostile human stalkers in a third. Ironically, the most accomplished primitive in the group is the old paleontologist, who seems to have knocked about the wilder shores of Galactica for more than a century while gleaning fossil bones. We are known to each other by first names only, and we may divulge such details of our background as we choose or don't choose. As you may imagine, this leaves a wide margin for parlor psychoanalysis, with the ex-meta lady as head games mistress. She had me taped as a questing lover after the first day, and I'm afraid that she anticipates a melancholy end to my masculine Evangeline fix, since she keeps trying to distract me with speculations on role-playing among the auberge clientele, the political implications of exile, and other anthropological amusements.